Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, September 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, hundreds of thousands are in need of help in the aftermath of Irma.
Issues with getting the water started back up, sewage, and their power back up.
North Korea responds to the latest sanctions. An Obama-era campus sexual assault policy is being reversed. Also ahead, news on Lady Gaga and a new documentary. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Hurricane Irma cut a deadly path through the Caribbean last week, leaving behind devastated islands before it hit mainland Florida. Experts say Irma's the biggest and longest-lasting Category 5 storm in recorded history in the Atlantic. About 40 people have been killed, several of them in Florida. Governor Rick Scott has surveyed the damage in the hard-hit Florida Keys, where 90% of homes are said to be damaged or destroyed.
I've been talking to the people down there. We're still having in the Keys issues with getting the water started back up, sewage, and their power back up. We've been sending the Department of Transportation down the Keys to inspect all the bridges, because even though you can see that people are traveling, you're not sure that on the bridges they can take any significant weight.
Authorities are sending crews to aid victims, restore power, and assess damage in Florida and states like Georgia and South Carolina, which also got slammed with the weakened but still powerful storm. VOA's Latika Hoek has more.
Irma has left more than 6 million Florida homes without power, and the Keys have been described as a war zone. The islands are cut off from the mainland as the roads and bridges connecting them are damaged. The White House said Monday, although the storm has weakened to a tropical depression, it remains dangerous. A spokesman said the East Coast city of Jacksonville has seen what is considered to be the worst flooding in a century.
As that flooding is ongoing, we have life-saving, life-sustaining operations underway, and we are prayerful that there are not people right now trapped by floodwaters.
Hundreds of power emergency trucks were dispatched Monday to restore electricity to neighborhoods left without power in the aftermath of the storm.
Utilities from all over the country are headed down there, and I think as far up as Canada as well.
Really?
So there are tens of thousands of utility workers that right now are mobilizing from across the country and going down to help with restorations.
The western coast was spared the worst, but strong winds damaged many houses and trees.
I tell you, it brought me to tears to see the trees down, to think how many years they've been around, and Mother Nature is taking care of them so well, and to see so many trees down.
On her way to Florida, Irma wreaked havoc in the Caribbean. Almost all of the homes were destroyed on the island of Barbuda.
It's a small island. It stood no chance against the monster that Hurricane Irma was. Hurricane Irma, in terms of its size, was larger than the island of Barbuda.
Ronald Sanders, Barbuda and Antigua ambassador to the United States, told VOA that it was the worst storm to hit Barbuda in 300 years and that all the residents had to be moved off the island.
There's no electricity, no potable water, no buildings in which to live.
The ambassador said the rebuilding will require structures that can withstand future storms that are bound to become stronger as a result of climate change. A weakened but still dangerous storm is now moving through Georgia toward Alabama. Both states have declared a state of emergency. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. North Korea is slamming new UN sanctions, warning of U.S. greatest pain. Orphan children are celebrating after Islamic State is removed from Mosul. The envoy says Antigua and Barbuda will rebuild from Irma. And Latino groups are snubbing Trump for disagreeable actions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, North Korea has strongly criticized the UN Security Council's decision to impose tough new sanctions against the East Asian nation and warned the United States would experience, quote, the greatest pain for playing a leading role in the effort. Pyongyang had warned before the latest sanctions were imposed that the U.S. would pay, quote, due price if it pushed for stronger sanctions. President Donald Trump told reporters at the White House Tuesday the new sanctions are nothing, really, compared to what could happen.
We think it's just another very small step, not a big deal. Rex and I were just discussing, not big, I don't know if it has any impact, but certainly it was nice to get a 15-0 vote. But those sanctions are nothing compared to what ultimately will have to happen.
International Edition's Sarah Williams asks VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul, South Korea, how North Korea's neighbors are reacting to the sanctions.
Mostly positive in Asia, in South Korea, Japan, and China. All are voicing support for these new sanctions. There's different degrees. Japan is very supportive of the sanctions and very much aligned with the U.S. policy to put the maximum pressure, which is the name of the Trump policy, U.S. President Donald Trump's policy for forcing the North Korean regime to recalculate and restrain itself and come to talks for dismantling its nuclear arsenal in exchange for a relief from sanctions and economic aid and security guarantees. So there's overall a positive response, but there is skepticism both among advocates of these very strong sanctions and among critics who believe that sanctions are going too far. Both say these sanctions are not going to have any significant impact.
Why do they believe that?
The hawkish side, who believe that sanctions will ultimately, strong sanctions will force the North Korean regime to pull back from its nuclear ambitions, they believe that these sanctions have not gone far enough because it puts some limits on the import of fuel, it puts some limits on the export of textiles and the export of workers, but it doesn't declare an entire ban on these industries that would, if there was a ban, would enact crippling economic pain and perhaps cause the whole North Korean regime under Kim Jong-un to collapse. So they believe that the sanctions don't go far enough. They believe that this is another incremental step. There was discussion, I guess, in the UN in which the U.S. was asking for much stronger sanctions and pulled back at the request of North Korea's key allies in the region here, Russia and China, and pulled back to these more incremental sanctions. It feels like we're revisiting old ground over and over again at an accelerated rate over the last year and a half, where North Korea conducts some sort of provocation, whether a missile test or a nuclear test, and the international community gathers for a new round of sanctions, and yet nothing significantly changes. And analysts I talked to said we're still kind of in that same gray area where the sanctions are not strong enough to really make the North Korean regime choose between survival and yielding to international pressure. So that's on the hawkish side. The side that is pro-engagement thinks that nothing that the international community and the U.S. and South Korea and Japan in particular can do will force North Korea to give up its present position. And the more the U.S. and its allies try, the more that North Korea will push back and conduct more tests because they see the aggressive moves by their enemies as more justification of why they have to maintain this nuclear arsenal.
That's VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul, South Korea. U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos says her agency will change its approach to handling cases of sexual assault on college and university campuses in the U.S. In a speech last week in Virginia, DeVos didn't detail how the rules will change, but said the Education Department would seek public input on revamping the Obama-era guidelines on dealing with campus sexual assault. Critics of the rules have charged that they pressure colleges to take harsh actions against the accused without affording them due process. But supporters of the Obama-era rules fear DeVos's speech signaled a step back for victims' rights. Joining me now to talk about it and get some perspective is San Diego-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro, who has worked in many of these cases. David, why do you think DeVos is looking to reverse these policies?
Could be one of two reasons. I'm hoping it was done to analyze what the accused is going through, meaning when someone's accused of committing a sexual assault on campus, to instill some principles of fundamental fairness to the accused and their right to have a fair, unbiased hearing, which may have gotten lost in the shuffle of the many good things through the Obama administration and Title IX and what have you was implemented. Could be just a blanket, well, we're going to try and undo everything of the previous 8 years. I hope it's not that. In fact, I'm actually a little bit encouraged, at least on the surface, that if they do this the right way, they have an opportunity to make these hearings more fair for everyone and ultimately get more justice for the alleged victim as well as for those people accused.
Now, do you think that right now things aren't fair for the people that are accused of sexual assault?
I could tell you, speaking from firsthand experience representing several individuals in these types of hearings, particularly in the state of California, it is 100% biased, 100% not fair based on what I've seen myself, where people are presumed to be guilty, they are kicked out of school, they are suspended from school. They basically need to prove that it was not 100% equivalent, yes, basically anything short of a signature. Consenting to sexual conduct is not enough for purposes of the school board. And I've witnessed several of my clients who were exonerated in criminal court. In some instances, charges were not even filed in criminal court because of the weakness of the evidence against them. And they still had to go through the school board process, and we had to appeal that decision to get them ultimately reinstated into school.
And what about all those years that we heard about colleges pretty much avoiding reporting incidents that looked to be pretty bad just to avoid bad publicity?
That's true. I mean, we're hearing stuff right now, particularly even in Baylor University with the football team, you know, something to the effect of 52 rapes have been alleged in a 4-year period regarding several football players themselves that the coach knew about. You hear stuff a couple years ago at Penn State with sexual assault of minors with the defensive coordinator there, that Joe Paterno, who's now deceased, his legacy is ruined, and rightfully so, based on his inaction, not doing anything about it. So I think certainly the idea that universities need to report this immediately, just an accusation, is appropriate. But I think it needs to be balanced out with making sure that the rights of the accused, that these people are protected as well, because there are cases, and a large majority of cases, where someone makes an accusation and it is unfortunate that things happened and it is a crime and these people should be punished. But I've seen, as a criminal defense attorney now and over the course of the past 10 years, particularly in California, you know, situations where someone could just make up an accusation with literally nothing other than their words to back that accusation up, and I've seen it ruin people's lives, people who've been accused where they haven't done anything wrong, just because of this, I don't want to say paranoia, but over concern about making sure that the universities do everything they need to do to placate the federal government, to placate this policy, without for a second considering what this must be like and what the rights are of the accused.
Well, it sounds like it evolved to this point from the lack of reporting incidents that were for fear of bad publicity, as we just talked about, sort of like an overcompensation maybe, is that what you're saying? And somewhere it needs to come back and meet in the middle?
Right. The pendulum needs to swing back more in favor of the rights or basically fundamental fairness of those accused of committing sexual assault on campuses. That doesn't mean necessarily that there should be less reporting or that the rules regarding reporting should be loosened. They should be held to that same standard, but we just need to put in more safeguards for those accused of these sexual assaults to make sure they get their fair shake and they're not kicked out of school based on unsupported or uncorroborated evidence.
Do you have any idea on the statistics of college campus sexual assaults in this country?
I know it's, you know, what's reported and what's actually going on is a whole other issue. You know, what's reported, I think assault has been reported more and more frequently, in large part because of these policies to try and prevent, you know, these types of instances going on. But what I could tell you is that, you know, there is still a large number, without having the number on top of my head, a large number of assaults and sexual assaults that do not get reported for a number of reasons.
So what's the solution to get more of these schools to report allegations and also to assure that both sides get fair legal representation?
I think what needs to be done first on the underreporting aspect of it. I mean, these universities and their administrators need to be hammered and punished severely because of it. When you have people prioritizing athletic programs or prized athletes, student athletes, and looking the other way, knowing about things, not doing things just to try and, you know, keep their football program afloat. I mean, that's just inexcusable on so many levels, especially when dealing with accusations of sexual assault, and particularly with accusations of sexual assault that have been proven true in a court of law. But I think what you need to do also is not just scrap the entire work of 8 years, of 20 years, of 40 years of policy here. I think what you need to do is take a step back, look at the entire process, and says, okay, what is working, what is not working? Well, what's working is, for the large part, these universities are reporting these claims. They are administratively, so to speak, prosecuting these offenders or these alleged offenders. But I think what we need to do is balance that out a little bit by making sure they have certain rights. They should have the right to an attorney, not only be there with them as their advisor, but to be able to speak on their behalf.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. San Diego-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro. Thanks.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now with celebrity news. And for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Hi, Nicole. So we're always looking for news about the British royal family. Everybody's excited about them. And, of course, any news about the children. Prince George, now, we hear, had his first day of school. Was it kindergarten?
So I guess it was kindergarten, maybe pre-K, because he is only 4 years old. But he did start his first day last week on Thursday. So there's been a lot of buzz about, what are the other kids at school going to call him? Do they have to call him Your Royal Highness, as he is the future King of England? But according to a former headmaster, he will be just another pupil at school, and he will be known as just George. But that also brought up some questions of, what will his last name be? When Harry and William were in school, they were known as William and Harry Wales all the way up to the time they served in the military, and that was a nod to their father, Prince Charles, Prince of Wales. So it sounds like George is doing kind of the same thing that his father did, and he has taken on Cambridge as his last name because William and Duchess Catherine are the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge.
Mm.
So he will be known as George Cambridge at school.
Really? Okay. All right. That's interesting. I wonder how he liked school.
I don't know how he liked it, but he said that right after his first day, his parents posted an official statement on Twitter and said that he had a very good day at school, and they were very happy with all of the love and support they got from their fans that day.
Nice. So you've also got some Lady Gaga news. What's going on with her?
Yeah, she's got an upcoming documentary. It's going to be on Netflix. It's called 5'2". And it's going to just deep dive into her life. And she talks a little bit about her relationship and the demise of her relationship with her ex-fiance, Taylor Kinney. He's an actor from the show Chicago Fire. And they broke up last summer, and it was very sudden. And a lot of fans were really, really surprised because they were all over the red carpet previous to the breakup, looking very cozy and comfortable and loving. And she said that at the time of their breakup, they were fighting a lot, and it was really hard for the two of them. And she said that you have to be moving together, and that's just not something she and Taylor were doing. She also said that her love life was imploding as her career was kind of taking off. But the two seemed to be still good friends. He was spotted at a recent concert of hers in Chicago, showing his support. And she has not said anything bad about him in the media. So it seems like even though it was a bad breakup, maybe behind the scenes, they are supportive and loving and friends at this time.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for filling us in. Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. And turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's it all about today?
It's about Facebook saying that about $100,000 worth of ads were purchased over a two-year period that did not jive with Facebook's terms of service. And a lot of these were used to influence people on different issues like guns and race and LGBT issues, and they suspect that some of these ads may have come from Russia. Well, now there's a group called the Campaign Legal Center, and they want Facebook to release information about these ads. Who was behind them? What were the specific ads? How were they connected to Russia? This is all part of that ongoing investigation into whether there was Russian meddling into the U.S. presidential election. As I mentioned last week with Steve Norman, these ads did not advocate for one candidate or the other, but they could have influenced people's decisions based on certain issues. So this group, Campaign Legal Center, wants CEO Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook to release this information and try to spell out what this meant and how this may have influenced people. Now, another report I saw said that this ad campaign, the $100,000 and these 3,000 or so ads that were purchased, could have been seen by anywhere from 23 million to up to 70 million Americans.
Whoa,
so it could have been seen by quite
intense.
A lot of people. So there's
certainly a lot of deal.
It is a big deal. Certainly a lot of interest in this. We're going to see this develop, I have no doubt. I think this is going to become a big part of this investigation as it goes forward. And we're going to see a lot of these connections between social and digital media and this influence campaign for the election. And it may not be as evident as we think. It may not be support this candidate or don't vote for this candidate. It may be much more subtle.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure we've all seen them and maybe didn't know that that's what it was at
the
time.
Absolutely. Could have been hiding in plain sight.
Right. Anything else?
Yes. A big announcement on Tuesday. Apple CEO Tim Cook announcing in the Steve Jobs convention center there, the Steve Jobs meeting place named after the late Apple CEO, the brand new iPhones, plural, because Apple is introducing the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10, which is actually, it says iPhone X, but the X is the Roman numeral for 10. This, of course, being the 10th year since they released the original iPhone. So lots of attention on social media to the new whistles and bells, wireless charging, wireless headphones. You're able to unlock the phone via Face ID because they don't have that touch button anymore on the phone. And that was actually something that caught Apple a little by surprise and got a lot of attention on social media because when they tried to test out that Face ID during this live reveal, it actually didn't work and they had to go to their backup phone to get it to work. So a little bit of a hang up there. I don't think it's going to hurt the sales, even though these phones are priced up to $999. Quite a bit of pocket change. A lot of money for a phone.
$999 is $1,000.
Yes. And that's if you want the top of the line iPhone 10 with all the bells and whistles.
What does it do for that? Does it clean your house?
You know, one thing I've seen throughout the social media reaction is that while people say, oh, you have to, you know, practically sell a kidney to buy one of these phones, a lot of people are saying, hey, I'm still going to buy it. You know
what?
It's worth it. And these Apple fans, you know, and not just Apple fans, tech fans generally want to have the latest and greatest, and they will go through any lengths to get it. And so they will pay quite a lot of money to do so.
All right. Well, to each his own if you have the money. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a new film from Academy Award winner George Clooney, Suburbicon, looks at racial tensions in a fictional 1950s white neighborhood. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film stars Oscar winners Matt Damon and Julianne Moore.
Welcome to Suburbicon, a town of great wonder and excitement.
Hey there.
Built with the promise of prosperity for all.
Suburbicon is an idyllic, white, small-town suburb where everyone has manicured lawns and all the children ride their bikes down the street in safety. Gardner Lodge, played by Matt Damon, lives in the neighborhood with his wheelchair-bound wife, Rose, her sister, Margaret, and their son, Noah. But Gardner has a dirty secret. He owes the mob money, and that leads to a bungled robbery attempt by two mobsters that causes Rose's death. Meanwhile, the Myers, an African-American family, have moved in next door. Nikki makes friends with the Myers' son, but their friendship touches off racial violence. Soon the Myers are being blamed for a series of grisly murders that are actually being carried out by Gardner Lodge. Academy Award-winning director George Clooney said at the Venice Film Festival that he wanted to shine a light on some of the anger in America in 2017.
People are angry, and a lot of us are angry. Angry at ourselves, angry at the way that the country is going, angry at the way the world is going. And this seems to reflect that. And I think that that's okay. I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that's probably a fair thing to do.
Matt Damon says that while the film was not directed at recent racial tensions, such as erupted earlier this year in Charlottesville, Virginia, it does highlight that race is still an issue in America.
We couldn't have predicted, obviously, you know, what when we were filming these race riots, that we would have something like Charlottesville, where, you know, we weren't literally thinking that, you know, race riots would erupt in America right before this came out. But it does speak to the fact that these issues have not and are not going away until there's an honest reckoning in our country.
One woman was killed in Charlottesville when white supremacists and Nazis clashed with counter-demonstrators over the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Julianne Moore, who plays Gardner Lodge's wife Rose and his sister-in-law Margaret, says she has no problem with the removal of monuments to Confederate leaders because they symbolize institutional racism and slavery.
They must be removed. You simply cannot have these figures from the Civil War in town squares and in universities for our children to see. As a parent and as a citizen, I need to be active in the eradication of those, in the re-education of everyone. We have to take responsibility for it. We can't just say the next generation will do it too.
Suburbicon also stars Noah Jupe, known for The Night Manager and Wonder as Nicky Lodge. The story is based on a script written by Joel and Ethan Coen in the 1980s, but never produced. It is rated R for violence and language. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations reports that despite reduced violence in some areas of Syria, unspeakable crimes against civilians have continued, including the use of chemical weapons against the Syrian people by the Assad regime. The UN's International Commission of Inquiry for Syria, led by Paulo Sergio Pinheiro, confirmed that Syrian government forces used chemical weapons more than 24 times since the conflict began, including in the deadly sarin gas attack in April 2017 on the town of Khan Sheikhoun that killed at least 83 people. Government forces continued the pattern of using chemical weapons against civilians in opposition-held areas, the report by the commission stated. In the gravest incident, the Syrian Air Force used sarin in Khan Sheikhoun, Idlib, killing dozens, the majority of whom were women and children. The report notes that Assad's aerial campaign also targeted medical facilities throughout the area, resulting in a severe weakening of their ability to provide assistance to victims of the sarin attack and a consequent increase in the number of civilian casualties. In addition, the commission reported that at least in three places, Idlib, Hama, and Eastern Ghouta, a suburb of Damascus, Syrian forces used weaponized chlorine. These attacks constitute clear violations of international humanitarian law and the Convention on Chemical Weapons, the report noted, which the Syrian Arab Republic ratified in 2013 following a previous sarin attack. After the report was released, the U.S. mission to the United Nations called for full accountability for chemical weapons use in Syria. The United States has long urged the international community to act to enforce UN Security Council resolutions against the use of chemical weapons and to hold perpetrators like Bashar al-Assad responsible for his crimes. In April, after the attack on Khan Sheikhoun, the United States destroyed the airfield in Syria from which the Syrian government's chemical strike was launched. The same month, the U.S. Treasury Department imposed sanctions against 271 employees of the Syrian government agency responsible for developing such weapons and the means to deliver them. As the evidence continues to mount of Assad's culpability, it is past time for the international community to ensure that such blatant disregard of international law and human decency stop, and that the perpetrators be held to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.